Welcome to the How Writers Write podcast, a show focused on inspiring and empowering you to become a better writer. Come along as we deconstruct the tips, routines, and motivations of your favorite authors. In the end, it's all about getting your story onto the page. Welcome to episode 102, How 3D Umrigger Writes. I am just so excited to bring this episode to you. Episode 102 with 3D is something special. In this episode, 3D and I discuss all sorts of parts of the writing life, and I think you'll tell from the very beginning that she is somebody that is both a master storyteller, but also somebody who just so deeply understands and loves and communicates so well all these little pieces about what it takes to be a storyteller. I found myself, again, just kind of sitting there and listening and enjoying every single moment. I want to take a very special minute and say thank you so much to 3D for her time, for winning so many wonderful awards lately, and for the publication of her novel this month in January 2022. And so now, my friends, without any further ado, here is the interview with 3D Umrigger. Welcome to the How Writers Write podcast. I am your host, Brian, Mr. Brian. And today's very special guest, I'm so excited for this interview, is 3D Umrigger. 3D is the best-selling author of many, many novels, including The Space Between Us, If Today Be Sweet, and The Weight of Heaven. She earned an MA in journalism and a PhD in English. She worked for several years as an award-winning reporter, columnist, and magazine writer. Her newest novel, Honor, is an Indie Next List pick for January 2022, as well as the January 2022 Reese's Book Club pick. Some late-breaking news there. Her books have been translated into several languages and published in over 15 countries. She is a distinguished university professor of English at Case Western University in Cleveland, Ohio. 3D is the winner of the Cleveland Arts Prize, a Lambada Literary Award, and the Seth Rosenberg Prize. She is also the recipient of the Nieman Fellowship to Harvard Award. 3D, welcome to the show.
Hey, Brian, it's great to be here.
I'm so excited to have you. And I've been saving this, you know, before like our chat, before we start recording, I've been saving this with the weirdest coincidence I've ever had on the show is happening right this moment, which is I was married on Case Western University.
No, come on.
True story.
For real?
True story. In the, you know, there's, so at Case Western, there's this beautiful chapel, old right? chapel. I was married inside of that chapel
to
my wonderful wife. I have these beautiful pictures because it's a stunning, beautiful, like historic building. And then we had our reception at some beautiful building. And then we did all of our pictures of this beautiful pond. Case Western is a stunningly beautiful university.
It's great. It's a gore. After all these years, I still pinch myself at times when I walk by.
Stunning. You know? So we took our pictures there. There it is. The coincidence after 105 or 10 or something interviews, the coincidence of all coincidences, I was married where you teach.
That's I have one question for you, Brian.
Yes.
Where was my invitation?
I know. If I'd have known 15 years later, I would have sent it to you. So I'm so excited to have you on the show. I'm so excited to talk about your writing life. I have had people on the show before that have had, you know, these big monthly book awards or big monthly book prizes where they're, you know, the Oprah Book Club or the Reese's Book Club. But I've never asked the question of like, what does it actually feel like to get the call that you've gotten this big book recognition?
You know, it feels very gratifying. And I'll tell you why. I mean, I'm sure if this was my very first book, I would have been over the moon, doing somersaults on the moon kind of
thing. Right.
But this is actually my ninth novel. So it's a very, I mean, in one word, it's wonderful. It's always wonderful when, you know, something happens that will bring your book to a wider audience than it might have otherwise had. That's just an unmitigated good thing. But mm-hmm. I'll tell you, for me, what has been the most gratifying thing about the last 2 weeks is people just, you know, well-wishers, fellow writers, you know, people I just know from social media, people in my personal life, but maybe perhaps because of the pandemic, people I haven't seen or mm-hmm. spoken to in a couple of years, people have just come out and have been so incredibly happy for me that it has just taken my own personal and professional sort of happiness to a totally different level, because now I feel like it's a whole community that's yeah. sharing in this good news. And God knows, as you know, from doing this show and otherwise, you know, being a writer doesn't always come with those kinds of rewards. So, you know, I'm old enough now to know that when good fortune comes your way, you greet it with open arms and a smile.
Yeah, that's such, you know, that's such beautiful advice, because so many times the writing life has these, you know, great peaks, but then also these tremendous down parts, these parts that are really challenging. And so it's good to have that perspective. It's almost like what I heard, and correct me if I'm wrong, what I heard is almost like this, taking it in stride, almost like every day by day, kind of the same. You show up, you write, there's good parts, you take it in stride, you get some great stuff, and you just keep going. Did I hear that? Is that kind of what you're?
Yeah, almost there. I think so. I mean, perhaps that is exactly what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, you know, next month there will be another book of the month, and the month after that, it'll be somebody else's turn in the spotlight. And that's exactly how it should be. You know, I think happiness and success multiply with distribution, as paradoxical as that might sound. So this month, perhaps this week, this moment is mine, and I'm claiming it. I'm not shying away from it. I'm enjoying it. But again, with having written so many novels, with having ridden those highs and ridden those lows, one knows that this is just part and parcel of the whole experience. I'm very glad that in my, you know, career, I've managed to ride some of those highs. I know that the lows are also inevitable. Perhaps it's part of the journey. Yeah. And the trick, I think, is to embrace it all.
Mm-hmm. See, sometimes as I'm doing the show, I hear things and I'm like, that alone is worth the price of admission. You know what I mean? Like that alone is worth somebody listening to, that this idea that like you just ride the whole thing, you know, there's going to be highs, there're going to be lows. There's something really powerful and stoic in it almost.
Well, it's, you know, it's life. I mean, this is not career advice. It's just, it's a description of all our lives. I mean, this is true. You know, whether you're an electrician or a plumber, I mean, there are good days and there are bad days. The trick is to know that all of that makes up your singular life, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. When you think back in your life, speaking of life, think back about your life, was there a book or a moment that made you think, I really want to tell stories? Like, this is important to me.
Yes. So you mean somebody else's work, right?
Yeah. Like, or just in general, was there this moment? I don't want to use the word awakening because it feels dramatic, but at some point this realization that there is this thing that you can do, which is to tell stories.
So, you know, I'll sort of step back in time a little bit, Brian, to answer this question. So when I was very, very, very young, I was already interested in the writing life. But also while I was quite young, you know, a young child in India, I knew that I loved words. I knew that this was something that I was good at. I knew it was the only way I had to make, you know, sense of my emotions, sense of the world around me, to express all that. But I didn't grow up in the kind of family where everybody was a dancer or a poet or an artist of some kind. You know, I grew up in a family of business people. And there was no path that I could see as a young child towards a creative or an artistic life, even though perhaps even without being able to articulate that is exactly the life that I wanted for myself. So by the time I was 8 or 9 years old, I did the next best thing, which is I went around telling whoever would listen to me, I wanted to be a journalist, you know, because in the way that kids have of knowing things that nobody has actually ever spelled out for them, I kind of had a feeling that being a journalist might be a way of splitting that difference, you know, where I would still have a profession, I would have a steady income, but I could still kind of lose myself in words. But I never did see myself as somebody who would write my own book. I always thought I would be somebody, I would be a scribe, you know, I would report back other people's words to them in newspaper articles or magazine articles or whatever. And then when I was 21, on the eve really of leaving to come to the United States for the first time, a friend of mine slipped a copy of a book in my hands to read on the plane. And she said, save it for the trip. It's a long trip to, from India to America. You'll need some good reading. And by some sheer good luck, that book happened to be a masterpiece, a book that most people consider one of the best books of the 20th century, Salman Rushdie's Midnight's Children.
Oh, it's one of my favorite.
And wow. You know, this was the first book that I ever read as a young adult that was set in the city of my birth, Bombay.
Yeah.
I recognized the names of the characters. I recognized the names of the streets. Everything that I had read for pleasure up to then had been mostly American writers. You know, I had up to that point, not in school and not for pleasure, read a single novel written by an Indian writer.
Wow.
So it made me see stars. I mean, needless to say, I didn't save the book till the plane ride. I sort of just scarfed it up, you know, in the next 2 or 3 days. And it affected me so much that I actually thought, why am I leaving? You know, Rushdie had this way of taking this rather drab, dirty, crowded city that I had grown up, you know, liking, but also kind of disdaining in some ways. He took it and he turned it into magic, which if you think about it, I mean, that's what a good book can do. You know, it's like somebody spinning gold in front of your disbelieving eyes, you know. Yeah. And but that book was so there, up there, that I never once thought, I can do this. I can write a book like this. It didn't inspire that feeling in me. It just made me crazy with like understanding the concept of there are stories everywhere, you know, and you don't have to be in Steinbeck's California or Faulkner's Mississippi to tell a good tale. You can be in Bombay, India and spin a very good yarn. And then several years went by, and I was walking on the campus of Kent State University with a friend, and she said, have you read this new book by this young Parsi Indian writer? And that's the community that I was raised in, by the name of Roynton Mistry. And the book was one of his earlier books, Such a Long Journey. And I said, no, I haven't. So I went out, bought the book and read that. And that was a book set in a community that I was raised in, which is this very small minority, you know, religious and some would say ethnic community in India. And when I read that book, I thought, my God, it really is possible to tell the stories that we know. And I would say these two books were kind of bookends for me in my writing life.
Can we go to, you just said something that really struck me. And first, it's such a just as a reflection, it's such a beautiful story. And one of the reasons I love doing this work so much is story is so universal to the human experience. You know, you can be from Steinbeck's California, you can be from India, and story is central to our experience as what it is to be alive and to be a human. And that is something that especially in a very fractured world, I find is uniting.
Yes.
If we can hear and tell our stories, we can really take steps closer to each other, maybe in a way that no other thing we can do with. Separate topic, and I can rabbit holes, but I won't do that.
Yeah.
You know, what I want to go back to is you said something just now, about how you, not, I'm going to paraphrase it because I can't remember the exact words, but something like, you're allowed to tell the stories, our stories, that it's allowed to be there. Can you unpack that a little bit? Like there was a realization that like your story meant something. Like, what did you mean by that?
Yeah, that's such a great question. I don't know if I have a ready answer for it. Mm-hmm. I think we write about what we see reflected of ourselves when we read. And as I said, I had a very, I guess you would call it a Western education. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that in turn, of course, influenced my own reading habits. So I sort of steeped myself in British lit, but mostly American lit, you know, 20th century, some 19th century American lit. And that was the world I knew. So it always felt like the books came to me from a distance, from somewhere far, far away, mm-hmm. you know, and, mm-hmm. and you really had to have something really profound and important to say. I guess what I'm saying is I didn't quite understand the value of daily life and how our ordinary daily lives are a kind of art, are a kind of storytelling. You know, I always thought of storytelling as something that came from the heavens, that sort of descended from the heavens and was presented to certain chosen writers, and certainly not writers who look like me or talk like me or grew up where I did, that kind of. And Rushdie and Midnight's Children sort of kicked that door open, and he showed me sort of the dazzle of all the possibilities that were out there. But I think as a young writer, that was too intimidating. His genius was too intimidating for me, you know? I needed something closer to home. I needed something smaller to unpack. And in his own brilliant way, Roynton Mysteries, Such a Long Journey, was a small, it was a story on a smaller scale. Yeah. And it made me think that it was possible to tell other stories on a smaller scale, and that I was up to that task.
Yeah. Boy, I love hearing that. It's just such, I just love your story. Do you feel as if that, it sounds as if you were earlier in life. So you're kind of early in your writing career. Do you feel as if that realization, that story is not always fantastical or massive on the scale of Midnight's Children, but is also intimate and immediate. Do you feel as if that had an impact with how you create in a way? Like did that translate into then story being more accessible in your everyday life in a way?
Yes, I think that's true. I think it did. I feel like it's easier for me, and in some ways I've become a proponent of telling the smaller, more intimate, the more specific stories, because, you know, as the saying goes, I mean, you want to tell a universal story, start by telling a very particular story and then leave it up to the reader's imagination to make those connections that makes the story larger and makes it universal. And I think, at least in my first two novels, that's very much, I tried to tell stories that were very close to my heart. The first was a novel called Bombay Time, and it was all the events in the book happened in the course of one evening at a wedding reception, and all the characters are neighbors living in this one apartment building, attending this wedding reception for the son of one of the neighbors. And these were none of the characters were actually based on characters that I grew up with, but it was set in a milieu and in a culture, Zoroastrian Parsi culture, that I was raised in and was very familiar with, you know. Mm-hmm. So that felt embraceable and authentic to me. But the story that I think I was dying to tell, perhaps from the time I was a child and didn't quite know it, was the story that ended up becoming The Space Between Us, because the relationship, the domestic relationship between the house, the head of a household, generally speaking, was female, and a domestic servant, and mm-hmm. this very complicated, interplay between two people from very different socioeconomic backgrounds, but living for all practical purposes under the same roof, and all the machinations and all the complexity of that was something that I used to observe when I was a kid. Yeah. It was something that always fascinated me, you know, this insider-outsider status that the help held within middle-class families. So at least those first two or three books were very close to me. And then I started, you know, as I felt more confident in my abilities as a writer, I was happy to take more risks to write about books that were set entirely in America, to have American characters, to have white characters, to have Black characters in my novels. I could flex my muscles a little bit more with each book.
Yeah, you used a word in there which is important, and I don't know how well I personally understand it. And it's my show, so I get to ask you whatever I want. part of the benefit, right, of being in my seat, which is authenticity. And I am someone who I deeply believe in the power of story, and deeply believe in the power of sharing your own story and listening to the story of another, whether or not it's an actual story or just pure fiction, whatever it might be. I believe there's truths in that are important for both the storyteller and the listener, the reader. So much of that rests on authenticity, authentically telling story. And I think that's something also a lot of writers, I don't want to say they struggle with, but I think that they, I think they would benefit from some guidelines, if that makes sense. And it's incredibly abstract. And so this is why I'm kind of like dancing around a question, which is this idea of like, how does one authentically tell a story? And then what leads to one inauthentically telling a story? What is the series of events that's the opposite of that, like authentic storytelling? I hope that makes sense.
it makes and it's a very good question. Not only does it make sense, it's actually a good question. So, you know, people always ask, who is your ideal reader, right? Mm-hmm. And I always feel like when you're writing, you know, at least the first few drafts of a novel, one should try and suspend all thoughts of an ideal reader. And again, I should just qualify what I'm about to say, Brian, by saying it's so individual, you know. Yeah. I mean, there are as many types of writers as there are readers, you know. Yeah. So this is just something I can only speak to what works for me.
Yeah.
I really, really try and write in, I don't want to say a bubble, because I want the world to act on me while I'm writing, but in a kind of cocoon is probably not the right word either, but I don't want to be distracted by the sounds of the outside world, and certainly not think in terms of what readers' expectations might be, what my agent wants from me, what my editor would like me to do next. I don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to think in terms of commercial success or failure when I'm writing those early drafts. The only thing I want to do and the only people I want to engage with are my characters, you know, because my job at that early juncture is to get to know them really, really well, like they're family members, like they're living in the house with me. And if I do that, the questions of what's authentic and what's not, what's another way of saying that I like to use is emotionally honest. I've always said that more than anything else, you know, I want my books to be emotionally honest. I mean, yes, I want to write, you know, the best prose that I can. I want language to flow. But if you ask me what my number one priority is as a writer, it's for my books to be emotionally honest, which is another way of saying authentic. And I feel like if I get to know my characters that well, I won't have to worry so much about plot. You know, I won't have to worry about, let's see, what should they do next? They will tell me, because they will act in accordance to the dictates of their own natures, their own personalities. And then that in turn simply becomes the plot of the novel, right? Mm. So I say this to my writing students too, like plot should never be sort of superimposed by the writer. You know, plot should spring organically from the ground up of a novel.
And the ground up is the character in this instance.
It should absolutely be rooted in character development.
Yeah.
And that's a long-winded of saying that way of saying that's what I mean by being authentic.
Yeah. I think the follow-up to that for me at least would be, how would one, if we want to make it a little bit more broad, but how do you get to know your characters in such a way? How are you spending time with them in a way that allows you to have such intimacy with this?
Well, they go on walks with me. That helps a great deal. We go on long walks together. We take long showers together.
Yeah, right.
We wash dishes together. And sadly, when I'm watching, you know, a work of art by somebody else, if I'm in a movie theater, pre-COVID, of course, watching a movie, they are sort of colonizing half of my brain and chattering to me throughout that movie and pretty much ruining that movie for me. But that's a small price to pay, you know.
Which
all of which is to say, it's the way you get to know anybody. You spend time with them, you know. And you dig and you dig and you ask yourself, you know, it's easy to know who people are in narrative time at the moment that the story begins, but it's equally important, if not more so, to know who they were in the past.
Yeah.
Right. So not every character always declares their backstory to the reader. It doesn't have to, but I think they need to do that to the writer. Like you have to know who they were to know who they are.
Yeah. 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 I've been dancing around a question for all the 2 years I've been doing this podcast, and it's kind of surfaced here, so I have to ask you your opinion on this, which is, do you look at these characters as being, and this is a crude way of saying this, right, so forgive my, like, my language is going to fail me here, but do you view them as being a figment of your imagination, or do you view them as being somehow separate and alive from you? Or some third option I didn't mention.
Yeah. I wish I was witty enough to come up with a funny third option. I can't. I mean, obviously, at some level, I know, you know, I'm creating these characters, and in fact, I've had some funny encounters with readers at like book groups and at book talks, where people have literally grabbed my arm and said, is Bhima going to be all right? Is so-and-so going to be all right? Like, what happened?
I have
to very gently say, you do realize these are fictional characters, right? You don't have to worry so much about them. But no, I think when I'm actually writing, they feel very real to me. Mm. You know, at that time, I'm not claiming ownership of them. You know, in those moments, I'm not thinking, oh, you belong to me. No, they very much, very much belong to themselves.
Yeah.
They belong to their families. They belong to the cities that they grew up in, all of that. So I think that kind of distance is almost not just necessary, but it's part and parcel of the act of writing, is that you have to. They are their own people on screen, on the page.
Yeah, I suspect I'll spend my whole life circling around that question, because to me, there's something unsatisfying about, you know, when a character has some breakthrough with you, or something happens and you're like, what in the world? Like, where did that come from? I didn't do that. I didn't think about that. I'm not smart enough for this to come out of me. And yet here it is. Here it's presented itself. There's something super unsatisfying for me, at least, to be like, it just bubbled up for myself, my subconscious, like somehow, like it's such an experience, and it has such an energy that I can't seem to get over this idea that it's originating from outside of me. And I don't know what, I'm not claiming anything along those lines, but it always just, I always just have this feeling like, I'm there to like observe, not necessarily create. And just that switch in that wording means a lot. I think right. There's a lot of implications in that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I agree. But yeah. But Brian, you know, I think what you just said about the subconscious is exactly right. I really think that for all of us, our subconscious is way wiser than our conscious brains are. Right. Because I mean, there's a lot more that goes into the development of the subconscious, you know, cultural influences, how we were raised, all of that, that may or may not be present in our conscious minds. Yeah. And I'm a great believer in trusting, like I sometimes just plonk my hands on the keyboard and type, because let it rip. You know, because I just feel like tapping into that, it doesn't happen with every single writing session, but those times when it does, it's a different kind of a high, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You leave yeah. that day's writing session satisfied, right? In a way that, yeah.
And before we get into the final question, just to close this out, you had mentioned how children have access to information that doesn't seem to consciously make sense. I believe, and I think there's a lot of support that it's their subconscious. They have easier access to it than what we do, right? Especially there's some sets up until like the age of 5 or 6, almost everything you say to a child goes straight into their subconscious, bypasses the conscious mind. And so when they have this genius, brilliant idea, and you're like, wait, where did you come up with that? It's this, I don't want to say more ancient wisdom, because I don't know if that's true or not, but it certainly feels that way. You know what I mean? And I also think what you described when you write, and it's just like you've been transported. It's almost the way you used to feel as a child when you played, that deep play, that disappear into a fairyland play. And that's what makes it so satisfying. You know, okay. I can keep going and going and going and going and going. No, and I'm looking at my time and I'm like, I got to rip this back. I got to get these final questions. Okay. Oh boy. I have just so enjoyed speaking with you, but here we are at the end of the show. And at the end of the show, I ask the same final questions to every single guest. And I do that. I always say the same kind of preamble for two reasons. The first one is because I like the answers. It's my show. I get to do what I want. The second reason is because the entire point of the show is that there's not one way to create. There is not one way to write. You, listener, as a writer, one of the most important things you can do to advance your range as a writer is just to learn how you create. And it's going to be different for every single person. It's different for me. It's different for every guest. You as the writer need to figure that out. And I'm hoping some of these answers give you an idea, maybe spark some curiosity, but then also just show that everyone has answered these differently. Every single one of these beautiful writers I've had on the show, they give different answers. There's not one way. Okay. So with that said, here's my first question for you, which is, what do you see your role in this world as a storyteller?
I think because I'm in this rather unique position of having lived in two very different cultures, India for the first 21 years of my life, and then in the US for the rest of my life, I hope this doesn't sound pompous, but I would like to believe that my books can act as a kind of bridge between different cultures. I never want to write a book set in India or in America or anywhere else and have people think that the story that I'm telling is only germane or only unique to that culture. You know, my hope as a writer always is that the takeaway is always, aha, so here I understand something about the functioning of this particular society. And now as a reader, let me make those mental connections to see if it illuminates any aspect of my life, wherever I am. So to act as a kind of ambassador between different cultures
I love that.
Would be a terrific feeling.
I love that. Okay, question number two. What is the one word that best describes you? Oh,
passionate.
Passionate. Oh, I can feel that too. Okay. Question number three. If you had to pick a spirit book, so this is a book that if you're able to die and be reincarnated as a book, this is the book you'd want to be reincarnated as. What book would it be?
Oh my God. Calvin and Hobbes, any of them.
Oh, wow. Okay. Okay.
We got... You didn't see that coming.
No, I did not. What can I just ask you, like, what is it about Calvin and Hobbes that brought that to mind?
Well, I mean, just, you know, Calvin is so irreverent you know, there is a kind of gentle philosophy in those books that I adore. But mostly it's just his wit and his, you know, impulsiveness and his ability to get into trouble, but somehow come out right in the end. It's, you know, I'm giving you a whimsical answer
A
whimsical question.
Yeah. Okay. Next question. Is there a specific tool, and it can be anything at all, pencil, software, chair, coffee, tea, anything, that you absolutely must have to write?
You know, you have to remember, I grew up in a newsroom where, you know, there were police scanners in the old days, and television sets, and editors barking commands at you, and yeah, headlines. Right. So I can pretty much write anywhere, and mm-hmm. I have pretty much written anywhere. But, you know, for the most part, I love writing in my office, and hopefully with the windows open, if it's a good day, looking out on my yard and on a desktop.
Okay. Question number five, how do you deal, and we kind of touched on this already, but be interested to hear your answer, but how do you deal with the constant ups and downs of the writing life?
Easier, I think, a little bit these days than early in the career. Mm-hmm. Early in the career, the highs were really high and the lows were devastating, you know. Yeah. But now I just, there's, you know, there's this ability now to just pull back a little bit from all of it and just see that it's a dance, you know, and if I'm lucky, you know, the dance will continue a little longer, although there's never any guarantee of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just, as long as the music's playing, you get up and you dance, and sometimes you do well and sometimes you don't.
Last question for you. If you could give one piece of advice to new writers out there, what would it be?
I think it would be to not look to people like me or anyone else for advice, but to find what works for you, you know, to find the time of the day to write that works for you, to find the frequency of how often you should write that's yours. I think it's really, really important to just know yourself as a writer, and what motivates you, what makes you want to do this, and to know that there is no rule or no law on earth that says thou must be a writer, you know. But if you really, really want this, then you should just do it. You shouldn't talk about it. You shouldn't use your words to talk away story ideas. You should actually get them out on paper or on the computer. That's actually about five pieces of advice.
I mean, it's a great, it's as good of a way
strung
to...
together with a lot of hands. You know?
It's as great of a way to wrap up this podcast as possible. Where can people find you online? Where do you hang out?
Well, I have my own website, www.omregar.com.
Okay.
And then I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. I have an author's page on Facebook. Okay. And once in a while, I'm on Instagram.
Okay. Any of those platforms, a place where you frequent more than any other, are you more a Twitter person or Facebook? Or?
Yeah, I would say I check my author page on Facebook pretty often and Twitter too. Yeah.
Well, I just want to take a moment and say thank you and acknowledge how fantastic of a 42 minutes I just got to spend with you. And I'm you give me so much to think about, but also I think one of the things I will take from this interview is you seem to have a very calm joy in the writing life. And it's been such a pleasure to be able to talk to you and learn from you and share this now with the rest of the listening writing podcast world.
Thank you, Brian. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank
really.
You. Thank you. Thank you again to 3D for her time. If you haven't yet, please check us out on iTunes. Leave us a rating and review. You can also find me on Twitter. I am tweeting more than ever. So if you want a direct access to the mind of Brian, find me there. Lastly, I just want to say thank you so much for listening, and I hope you have a wonderful week of writing.